This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. This month, Pete Early, a former Washington Post reporter, came to the University of Arkansas as this year's featured author in the annual One Book, One Community Project. It's a project that invites everybody to read, then discuss an important book. Early was asked to come here to talk about his book, Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness. The book follows Pete's real son's battle with mental illness and also takes readers through jails and prisons where people with mental illness are placed when there is seemingly no other alternative. While he was in Fayetteville, Pete Early delivered a public lecture on the U of A campus, met with students and community members, and participated in a forum with me at the Fayetteville Public Library called The Gathering of the Groups. That event invites members of several area book clubs to come listen to the author and take part in a question and answer session. I began our part of the conversation at the library by asking Pete Early about the first word in his Pulitzer-nominated book, that word, crazy.
Well, publishers like one-word titles. And I, at the time I was doing my research, I honestly did not realize how offensive that word is and how stigmatizing it often is to persons who have mental illnesses. So I didn't fight them when they wanted to use the title crazy, but the main reason I didn't fight them was I've always felt, and from the moment I wrote the book, that we were really talking about the system. Unfortunately, it offended an awful lot of groups, and in fact, the NAMI had to kind of put it through its stigma clearinghouse, and Mental Health America actually initially told me that they were not going to back the book or support the book because of the title. And then after they read it, they ended up giving me an award. But it was, I mean, stigma is very, very real to persons who have mental illness. And it's so pervasive. It's like, I had covered deinstitutionalization in Oklahoma. I had written stories about our changing mental. I thought I knew a lot about mental health. And then when it happens to you and you realize just how ignorant you are, you're just kind of shocked. And this removed the scales from my eyes. And if you look, a few weeks ago, you'll see all these examples of stigma. A few weeks ago, Dr. Phil, who should know better, said that people who are crazy bark at the moon and eat rocks. Dr. Oz has made comments. Jay Leno constantly makes comments. Even our own president has said at various times, implied that people with mental illness are all violent and dangerous. And that kind of thing just is so stigmatizing that it just wears people down and also causes a lot of damage.
Well, after the nearly 400 pages reading, I still think the four most chilling words in the book are the first four in the book. I had no idea. Yeah. Because when we don't have an idea of what's going on, nothing will change. Yeah. And if a Washington Post reporter has no idea, I mean...
Well, it gets worse than that.
Oh, okay.
Because, look, if you read my book, you realize I tried to get my son help and I couldn't get him help. And I end the book, and it was interesting. I'll tell you a little insight. When I did my prison book, I kept myself out of it. With this book, I tried to write it keeping myself out of it. I actually was not a character in this book. And the publisher said to me, we're not going to print it. They said, it's like a wagon wheel. Mental illness is at the center, but you have all these spokes. You have this character here, Ted Jackson. You have this character here, Alison Collier. You have your son, but you stay out of it. It doesn't make any sense. Nobody can follow it. And a good friend of mine said, Pete, you have to be the character. You have to take people on a journey. All good writing takes readers on a journey. And hopefully you introduce characters, you introduce drama, and you introduce conclusion, and hopefully you introduce some kind of redemption. He said, you need to do that. You need to apply fiction to this book. And so then I became a character and went through it in that manner, and it seemed to coalesce and pull it all together. My book ends with a happy ending. My son and I are having steak. He seems like he's doing well. Everything's great. We're going to move on with life. 2 years after he got off his probation ended, he stopped taking his meds, and he started getting sick. Now, I'm going to tell you this. I'll try to be real brief here because I know you have questions, and I tend to ramble. I knew he was getting sick. I called the crisis mobile response team and said, please come. My son's off his meds. He needs help. They said, is he dangerous? I said, no. And they said, well, we don't come if he's dangerous. The night he became violent, the night I didn't have to lie, I called that same dispatcher. I said, my son is violent. And they said, well, wait a minute, is he dangerous or violent? And I said, he's violent. And they said, oh, we don't come if they're violent. Call the police. The police came. They shot my son twice with a taser, hogtied him, and took him away. Now, stop and think about that. And your question prompted this response. I'd written a book about our mental health system. I'm not personally wealthy, but I live in one of the wealthiest counties in America, Fairfax County, Virginia. Average income, household income is $150,000 a year. I had connections with Mike Wallace and Washington Post and news organizations. I couldn't get my son help even after doing all that. So what chance did somebody who doesn't have those connections, I mean, that's the reality we're living in today. So you asked me about crazy, you asked me about the book. In the 6 years since then, my son has been through many other incidents, and you know, the story continues. It doesn't just end because of a happy ending by an author.
Well, and I was thinking that as I read it, because some of the people who don't have a family life, who don't have perhaps the personal income behind them, are people you saw
absolutely
in the jails and prisons that you visited.
Yeah.
And we see what happens.
Yeah, and I can guarantee you, I don't know if anybody here from the legal community, but if Fayetteville is anything like most communities, you got 16% of your people in jails and prisons who are there not because they're psychopaths, but because they have a mental illness, untreated mental illness. They've been picked up for trespassing. They've done something stupid, and there's no safety net, and so they end up. I did run a few figures before my speech last night, and one of the statistics about Arkansas that struck me was that if you get in a situation like mine where your son or a loved one has a breakdown like mine did, the chances in Arkansas of that person ending up in treatment versus ending up in jail are 3-1 in favor of jail. And that's actually low. In some states, it's 6, 7, 8-1.
Well, as you point out in the book, not much good is going to happen there. These are prisons who may have a doctor on staff, maybe a doctor and a part-time doctor. And the doctor-to-patient ratio is ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, 12 seconds?
Yeah.
That you can spend with a patient?
Well, let's look at Arkansas again. See if I can remember these statistics. You have about 890-some psychiatric beds in all your hospitals across the state, which is good. You should have about 50 beds per 100,000. You have 6 beds per 100,000 people, so it's not really that good, but you do have 890-some psychiatric beds in public and private hospitals. You have 3,400 people just in your prison system who have a severe mental illness. So even if all those people are kicked out of your prison system, and there would be no place for them. And if you want to really compare apples to apples, your Arkansas State Hospital has about 96 beds for forensic patients, people involved in criminal justice affairs. So you have 36 times more people in your jail, in your prisons, than you have beds for psychiatric patients in your state. And that's not counting county jails. And if Arkansas is anything like Virginia, and hopefully you're ahead of us, we don't even know in Virginia how many people we have in our county jails because they don't ask and nobody's trained. And so, you know, you can be stuck in a county jail somewhere, be psychotic. You'll come in on a trespassing charge. You'll become even more ill because of the environment. You may take a swing at an officer or do something more egregious. You'll get charged with another crime, and all of a sudden you're stuck in this system and can't get out.
You talk about in the book, and for the benefit of people who haven't read the book, let's talk a little bit about deinstitutionalization.
Sure.
You had a period in the middle of the last century when there were state hospitals.
Right.
And by all accounts, most, if not all of them, were dreadful. Popular fiction, there was the Joan Crawford movie Snake Pit.
Right. Right.
And there was a movement to change things. And it seems like through a confluence of good intentions, penny-pinching, and ignorance, the situation was either static or became worse because now people who might have been in horrible state hospitals were now being shipped to prisons or jails.
What you discover is that the history of mental illness is a history of money. And what happened was Dorothea Dix in the 1800s visited a Boston jail, saw that people were freezing. There was a part of the jail that had no heat, and she went to the jailer and he said, oh, those are lunatics. They don't feel the cold. They don't need heat. And she started preaching that people with mental illness needed treatment, not punishment, and she got 33 states to build hospitals, and that sounded fabulous. But over the next 50 years, these people were a low priority. And hospitals became dumping grounds. They became poorhouses. And so what happened then was in fact, in 1960, in Oklahoma, my native state, there was a newspaper expose, and 60s weren't that long ago for some of us, okay? We still remember the 60s, okay? I say that to my kids, and they go like, oh, that's ancient history. I'm going like, no, I remember this. They called them, you know, they said they were worse than Nazi concentration camps. Okay. So there was this movement, civil rights movement, transferred to mental illness, and they said, you shouldn't get arrested if you have mental illness. You shouldn't be stuck in a place and have a ice pick shoved up under your eyelid and your brain scrambled. You should have a right to say, you can't do that to me. And they targeted commitment because the lawyers involved in this thought that commitment was awful, that no one should ever be forced in a hospital. And so you had this civil rights movement that made it almost impossible to get people in these places. And then Uncle Sam came in and basically said, we want to shut these places down. People belong in the communities. John Kennedy's great community mental health. And so everybody said, great, let the feds take care of them. We pushed them out the door. We elected Ronald Reagan. No offense to Ronald Reagan backers. We said, cut the government. I'm giving you the simplistic view. He began cutting the programs, we said. So you had this community system that's never been properly funded. It can't, I mean, in Virginia where I live, Fairfax County, one of the wealthiest counties, if you have a mental break right now in Fairfax County and you call up the county and say, I need help, do something, they'll tell you there's a 2-week wait before you can see anybody. And there is a 6-month wait to get somebody who actually looks at your case, a case manager, doesn't just put a Band-Aid on, and an 18-year wait to get into any kind of housing. So that's where we are today. And I don't know what it is here in Fayetteville. I wish I did. But can you imagine if you had a heart attack right here in the library and somebody called and they said, well, you had to wait 2 weeks before we see anybody? And that's the reality for mental health.
Well, and that goes back to the stigma, because We all use the term mental illness, but I don't know if we all intellectually think about what we're saying. If I were to have a stroke or a heart attack right now, you'd have instant help. But so much of our framework still doesn't think of mental illness as illness like that. And until that is challenged.
And Kyle, there's a reason for that, and that's really an important point. I'm glad you brought that up. We often think that people who have mental illness, it's a moral character flaw, they're faking it, they're just lazy. And part of the problem is, and I didn't know this when I wrote my book, but I later learned it rather quickly, is we don't have any biomarkers. We can't, if you break a leg, it's obvious you broke a leg. We don't have any tests that go, oh, you have schizophrenia, oh, you have bipolar disorder, oh, you have borderline. These are clusters of symptoms described by the patient that the doctors get together and say, hey, guess what? It's not normal to hear voices telling you to kill yourself, so you have a thought disorder called schizophrenia. It's not normal to wake up in the morning and be so depressed you can't get out of bed, and then by nightfall think you're God's gift to all women and you're running around charging bills thinking you can do, that's bipolar disorder, you must have a mood disorder, and then all these between. So we have our own human frailty saying this is odd behavior, and of course that irritates people. There are people who don't think mental illness exists. And I found out, wow, even in the own mental health community, you have groups of people who say, look, I have a mental illness, but I'm not arrested. I don't break the law. If they get arrested, then that's their fault. Don't classify me as one of those people. So it was eye-opening.
We have this thin line, and you went through this with your son, where there are civil liberties, civil rights. And if your son was 25 at the time when the
22,
right, when the, but an adult,
right, absolutely.
And if he doesn't want, if he's not a danger and he doesn't want to take medicine, he doesn't have to.
That's right.
So here you are, his father. I can't imagine seeing, knowing he's ill, but your hands are tied. And it, again, it goes back to this good intention from sometimes 50 years ago to protect people.
That's right.
You know, people get the image of one flew over the cuckoo's nest.
That's right.
So how do
it's not a, only not only are you not allowed, you're the enemy.
Yeah.
You literally, if you're a parent and you take your son into most hospital settings, they will want to separate you. They will accuse you of just trying to dump your child there. I had a judge tell me that. They will be suspicious of you. They will blame you. We're not that far away from the schizophrenic mother, the idea that mothers cause schizophrenia by dressing their boys in dresses, you know, I mean, just ridiculous. And until we can prove that these are biological and genetically based illnesses, we're going to run into a lot of that prejudice. So not only do you run into hostility, but you run into a system that has by design now and starvation of funds is a total triage system. If you are absolutely at the bottom, you can probably get help. But they want you to get there. They want you to become dangerous. They want you to be homeless. They want you to be the person who's completely incoherent and messing in his pants before they want to intervene. And that's partly due to the fact that we don't have any facilities.
You write about the gentleman that you first met in the Miami prison who was in. He gets out. He wants to go fishing. He discovers this video cassette. And you take us through what starts out as a day for any of us, and suddenly he's back behind bars because there's nothing, the system has nothing else to do.
Right. Ted Jackson's an interesting character because he actually wanted to get better, and he actually didn't mind taking meds. In fact, if you read the book, you'll see at one point he gets scared, and he like quadruples his medicine, and he's taking these strong antipsychotics that would have killed most of us. But he's one of these people we know, and there's some debate about this, but the National Institutes of Mental Health says that about 85% of people can be helped by medication. And we know if we add other services in and other ways of treatment that we can reach a majority of people who have mental illnesses. They can recover. They can live relatively normal lives. You know, I mean, there are probably people in this room right now who have a mental illness who you would never suspect. I mean, there's a lot of people with mental illness who don't end up in jails and prison. But he wanted to get better, and he couldn't. And that's something that really upsets me, because after years and years and years of people with mental illness being told, you'll never get better, you need to be locked up, you need to be put away, you can't accomplish anything, we came up with the recovery movement. And we now believe that everybody can recover. And that's wonderful, because if you don't have hope, if you don't believe you can recover, then you never will. But we're abandoning people who aren't going to recover. And that's heresy to say right now in the mental health world. But I've met people in the jails and prisons who, by God, getting them out and getting them better is going to be extremely, extremely difficult. And they may never get better. And we have abandoned those people because we don't want to believe they exist.
So many of these people who are sick, who end up in jails, in prisons, whether it's C-Wing or wherever, the people that have any authority over them at all have little to absolutely no training.
Yeah.
And there are training programs available. And the best of those trainings start to change things, because people who go through them, whether they're police officers or correctional officers in the institutions, change how they view these individuals.
Yeah. Crisis intervention training for police officers. Police officers see more people with mental illness than psychiatrists do.
Right.
And that not only changes your outlook on these people, but it changes whole departments, it changes communities, because once you have a CIT in force, then the officers say, well, why am I taking this person in the emergency room where they're just going to turn them loose for 2 hours? Why don't we have a crisis center where we can drop them off, where they can be channeled into work? Or why don't we have a mental health court where a judge knows these people need treatment, they don't need punishment, it's not going to do any good to lock them up and then turn them loose and lock them up and turn them loose. So let's get them geared into services. Let's find housing. Let's find jobs. Let's find whatever programs they need to improve and benefit from their lives. Why don't they want to take medicine? You know, my son, I said last night, my son's had 7 psychiatrists. Only 2 have bothered to learn anything but his name and symptoms, because, you know, their job is to stick a pill in his mouth. Well, treating the mind requires treating the heart. So that is exactly right. That's how you start. And the way I do it, here's what I learned on the trail, is if you have a county commissioner, if you guys have some great political leaders here, if I go in and I say, you should fix your system because this is just wrong, they're going to say, thank you very much, Mr. Early. And then right after me, somebody's going to come in and say, you know, our schools are overcrowded and we need to do something about that. And then many people are going to come in and say, you know, the traffic around here is just getting ridiculous. And, you know, we got to do something about that. And on our priority, what always happens is mental illness, especially people mentally ill in jail, are going to be at the bottom. So what you have to do, what I try to do, is go in there and say, look, this person who's sitting in your jail is costing your community $30,000, $40,000 a year, and they're not getting any better. We can help them for half that price and get them better and turn them into productive citizens. I think that's the sales pitch we got to use. But the bottom line is, people with mental illness are never going to be the political force that other subjects carry.
The advocacy is just not there.
We don't have votes and we don't have money. Now, there's a way to change that. And the way to change that is to broaden the definition of mental illness. AARP should be involved in this. Sheriff's Association should be involved in this. Religious groups should be involved in this. If you have a mental illness, you touch almost every aspect of your community. It's not just a mental health problem. It's a community problem. And if you start looking at it as a community problem, then it has a lot more clout.
Pete Early is the author of several books, including Crazy, A Father's Search Through America's Mental Health Madness. He was in Fayetteville earlier this month as the featured author of this year's One Book, One Community, facilitated by the University of Arkansas. Our conversation was recorded at the Fayetteville Public Library as part of the annual event, The Gathering of the Groups, which is a partnership between the library and many area book clubs. In a moment on this Day After Thanksgiving edition of Ozarks, another conversation from this autumn that we haven't yet aired. Singers and songwriters Eric Brace and Peter Cooper came from Nashville to Northwest Arkansas to play a couple of shows recently, and they played some music inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio as well. That's next on this brand new edition of Ozarks at Large.